48. The Double Agent. Not counting Roly-Poly Gustav with the pink ears, Doronin was the youngest Zek in the Sharashka. His good nature, his readiness to oblige, and his liveliness won all hearts. During the few minutes in which volleyball was allowed, Rastislav gave himself heart and soul to the game. If those nearest the net let a ball pass, he would dive forward from the baseline, dig out the ball and fall to the ground, grazing knees and elbows till they bled. People liked his unusual first name, too, Ruska. It fully justified itself 2 months after his arrival, when his head, shaved in the camp, had grown a mop of red hair. He had been brought from Vorkuta because the Gulag had him down in its card index as a milling machine operator. The phony machinist was quickly replaced with a real one, but Ruska was spared the return journey to Vorkuta when Dvayetyosov undertook to teach him to operate the smallest of the vacuum pumps. Ruska soon got the hang of it. He clung to the Sharashka as though it were a rest home. He had suffered all sorts of hardships in the camps, and talked about them now with gleeful abandon. How he was nearly a goner working in a wet pit. How he had learned to skip work by pretending every day to have a high temperature, warming both armpits with heated stones of equal size, so that there would never be more than a tenth of a degree difference. They tried to catch him by using two thermometers. But though he laughingly recalled his past, which would certainly repeat itself sometime in the future since he was in for 25 years, Ruska revealed himself to very few, and only under oath of secrecy in his major role, that of an absconder who had led the MGB sleuths by the nose for 2 years. A worthy godchild of that organization, he was no more desperate for publicity than it was. He did not stand out from the rest of the motley crowd in the Sharashka until that September day. The day on which Ruska approached in turn with a mysterious look on his face, the 25 most influential prisoners, those who shaped public opinion in the Sharashka, and excitedly told each of them, tête-à-tête, that Major Shikin had that morning sought to recruit him as an informer, and that he, Ruska, had consented, with the intention of using his new position for the common good. Rastislav Doronin's colourful dossier was adorned with 5 changes of name, and all sorts of black marks and cryptic symbols, showing how dangerous he was, his predisposition to escape, and the need to keep him handcuffed in transit. But Major Shikin, eager to reinforce his team of informers, calculated that, being young, he was pliable, that he valued his place in the Sharashka, and that he would therefore be loyal to his operations officer. Secretly summoned to Shikin's office, you would be summoned perhaps to the secretariat and told, "Oh yes, just look in on Major Shikin." Rastislav spent 3 hours with him. In that time, as he listened to the godfather's boring instructions and explanations, his sharp eyes had studied not only the Major's large head, which had gone grey over his files of denunciations and spiteful tittle-tattle, his dark face, his tiny hands, his feet in boy's shoes, his marble desk set and his silk blinds. He had also read the headings on files and the pieces of paper under the glass desktop, mentally inverting the letters, although he was sitting 1.5 meters from the edge of the desk, and had still found time to work out which documents Shikin seemed to keep in the safe and which he locked in his desk. From time to time, Doronin's ingenuous blue eyes gazed into the Major's, and he nodded in agreement. The blue-eyed naivete concealed a seething mass of wild ideas, but the operations officer, who was accustomed to the grey uniformity of meek compliance, could not know that. Ruska knew very well that Shikin could send him back to Vorkuta if he refused to become a stoolie. Not only Ruska, but Ruska's whole generation had been trained to think of pity as a degrading sentiment, of kindness as comic, and of conscience as priest's talk. On the other hand, it had been drilled into them that informing was at once a patriotic duty, the best way to help the subject of your denunciation, and good for the health of society. Ruska did not take all of this in, but it had a certain influence on him. The main question for him now was not whether becoming a stoolie was a bad thing or permissible, but where it would get him. Young as he was rich in experience. He had lived a turbulent life, met many interesting people in prison, listened to any number of fierce prison disputes, and never lost sight of the possibility that all these MGB archives might be exhumed some day, and the secret collaborators face disgrace and prosecution. So that agreeing to cooperate with the Godfather was as dangerous in the long term as was refusal in the short term. But, quite apart from all these calculations, Ruska was a virtuoso adventurist. As he read the intriguing bits of paper upside down under Shekin's glass desktop, he shivered in pleasurable anticipation of an exciting game. He had wearied of inactivity in the claustrophobic comfort of the Sharashka. Inquiring exactly how much he would be paid, in order to make it look convincing, Ruska enthusiastically agreed. When he had left, Shekin, well satisfied with his psychological acuteness, walked about his office rubbing tiny palm against tiny palm. Such an enthusiastic informant gave promise of a rich harvest of denunciations. Meanwhile, a no less complacent Ruska made the rounds of those Zeks in whom he had confidence, confessing that he had agreed to become an informer for the sake of the sport, because he wanted to study MGB methods, and also to expose the real Stoolies. Even the older Zeks could remember no similar confession. They asked Ruska doubtfully why he was risking his head by boasting. His answer was, "When there's a Nuremberg trial for this dog pack, you will give evidence in my defense." Each of the 20 Zeks who heard his news told one or two others, yet no one went and reported it to the Godfather. This in itself put some 50 people safely beyond suspicion. Ruska's adventure caused a stir in the Sharashka. People trusted the boy, and went on trusting him. But, as always, the course of events had a logic of its own. Shekin demanded material. Ruska would have to give him something. He made the rounds of his confidants and complained to them. "Gentlemen, you can imagine how much telling all the others are doing. I've only had the job a month, and Shekin is really putting the pressure on. Look at it from my point of view, and slip me a scrap of material." Some of them didn't want to know about it, but others slipped him something occasionally. It was unanimously decided to ruin a certain female who only worked out of greed, boosting the thousands her husband took home. She treated the Zeks with contempt, frequently voiced her opinion that they should all be shot. She only talked like this among the female free employees, but the Zeks soon got to know about it. And she herself had thrown two of them to the wolves, one for an affair with a female employee, the other for making a suitcase from material belonging to the state. Ruska told a pack of shameless lies about her. She posted letters for Zeks, stole condensers from the store cabinet. Although he could not offer Shekin a shred of proof, and although the lady's husband, an MVD colonel, protested emphatically, nothing could prevail against such a secret denunciation. The lady was dismissed and left in tears. Sometimes Ruska informed on prisoners, too, reporting innocuous trifles and with due warning. But then the warnings stopped. He kept his intentions to himself. No one questioned him, but they could not help knowing that he was still bearing tales of a sort he could not own up to. So Ruska was overtaken by the fate of all double dealers. As before, no one gave his game away, but everyone began to steer clear of him. The scraps of information he passed on about the timetable under Shekin's glass desktop, showing when each of his informers could pop into his office unsummoned, and thus showing when they could be caught in the act, did not altogether compensate for his own membership in the Stoolie fraternity. Nershin was fond of Ruska in spite of his intrigues, and did not suspect him of telling Shekin about the Yesenin volume. Losing the book had hurt Gleb in a way that Ruska could not foresee. He had assumed that it was Gleb's property and that, once this was made clear, it would not be taken from him. In the meantime, Shekin could be kept happy with a report that Nyerzhin had a book hidden in his case, no doubt brought in by one of the girls. With the fragrance of Clara's kiss still on his lips, Ruska went out into the yard. The lime trees, white with snow, seemed to him to be in bloom, and the air seemed warm and spring-like. In his 2-year game of hide-and-seek, he had been so preoccupied with boyish schemes to fool the sleuths that he had given no thought to the love of women. He had gone to prison a virgin, and now his evenings were a torment for which he found no solace. Now, as he went out into the yard and saw the long, low headquarters building, he remembered that he meant to put on a show there at dinner time next day. The time had come to advertise it. To do so earlier might have ruined everything. Still under Clara's spell, and feeling three times as clever and sure of himself because of it, he looked around, spotted Rubin and Nyerzhin at the far side of the exercise ground, and made straight for them. His cap was pushed back to one side, so that his whole brow, part of his crown, and a lock of hair were trustingly exposed to the not very cold air. As Ruska approached, he could tell from Nyerzhin's stern look and the frown that Rubin turned on him that he had interrupted a serious conversation. Obviously, for his benefit, they switched to something unimportant. Still, he swallowed his resentment and said his piece. "You are, I hope, familiar with the general rule in just societies that all labour must be remunerated? Well, tomorrow is the day when each of the Judases will receive his 30 pieces of silver for the third quarter of this year." Nyerzhin feigned indignation. "You mean to say those tight-fisted so-and-sos are just paying them for the third quarter? They've worked four quarters, surely?" "The payroll needs a lot of signatures," Ruska explained apologetically. "I will be one of those collecting." "You mean you get paid for the third quarter, too? You've only been on the job half a quarter." "Ah, but I've distinguished myself." Ruska treated them both to a disarming smile. "Do you get paid in cash?" "God forbid! You get a phony money order, and its face value is credited to you. They asked what name I wanted them to use for the sender. How about Ivan Ivanovich Ivanov? I was flabbergasted. How corny can you get? Can't you make it out as from Klava Kudravtseva?" I said. "It's nice to think that some woman cares about you." "So how much do you get a quarter?" "That's the really clever bit. Officially an informer is allowed 150 rubles a month, but to make it look respectable, it's sent by mail, and the heartless post office takes 3 rubles in postal charges. The godfathers are too miserly to make it up from their own pockets, and too lazy to suggest a 3-ruble raise for stoolies. So the money orders will all be for 147 rubles. Since no normal person ever sends a money order for such a sum, those missing 30 10-kopeck pieces are the mark of Judas. At dinner time tomorrow you must crowd around headquarters and examine the money orders of those who've been to see the operations officer. The motherland should know who its stoolies are, don't you think, gentlemen?"